I'm Herman Pretorius, Deputy Head of Policy Research at the Institute of Race Relations. On the 2nd of April 2020, the Institute of Race Relations held a press briefing on the challenges South Africa is likely to face in lieu of the COVID-19 pandemic. The IRR's CEO, Dr. Frans Cronier, laid out a set of scenarios based on the newest available data to understand what the future might hold for South Africans amidst this crisis. IRR analyst Nick Babaya presented and discussed 10 policy proposals drawn from IRR research on how South Africa can mitigate the effects of COVID-19 socially and economically, and how South Africa could save lives and livelihoods through the right policy decisions. This is that press briefing. A few introductory remarks from my side. The COVID-19 crisis has hit South Africa quite hard, as it has hit the world. The realization, however, that the data shows us or needs us to understand is, to quote Davy Ruut, the economist, that we are entering a crisis on top of other crises. So the Institute of Race Relations, when this crisis hit, decided to make its full resources in terms of research and policy analysis available to the efforts to make sure that South Africa can adopt the necessary policies and take the necessary approach to save lives and save livelihoods in this difficult time. We are a socio-economic think tank. Our strengths lie in coming up with solutions, and South Africa, perhaps now more than ever in recent times, desperately is in need of solutions. But to understand what solutions we need to understand what the future is likely to hold. In that regard, Dr. Frans Cronier is an expert in scenario planning and analysis, and he will today be taking us through scenarios the IRR has constructed so that South Africans can understand what might happen. Now, I need to make clear at this point, we are not making predictions. We are not making forecasts. The point here is not to say IRR announces end of the world as we know it. The point here is very much to inform South Africans as to what might happen, what the data tells us is possible to happen, and to understand that. If South Africans can understand what the future could hold, especially taking into account the methodology of scenario planning, then South Africans can start planning their lives, whether they are individuals, businesses, government officials. They can understand what is likely to happen under what circumstances in this country. So today's briefing will consist of two parts. Dr. Cronier will be taking us through his scenario analysis, and then my colleague Nick Babaya, an IRR researcher, will introduce a series of 10 policy proposals that the IRR has developed over these last few weeks to contribute to the national discussion as to how South Africa can save lives and livelihoods. We will be taking questions, and I would ask you to please type your questions in the chat function of this briefing. The questions will be addressed after both Dr. Cronier and Mr. Babaya has spoken, and I will try to moderate as much as I can. I do apologize if I am perhaps overly strict, but my experience indicates that if strictness in these electronic scenarios aren't minded, we might have difficulty following what is said, understanding what is said. So if you have a question, please do type it in the chat function, and during question time, I will then come to you and appropriately direct the questions and ask colleagues of mine to answer. I will be muting everyone's microphones throughout the briefing, except, of course, the speakers. And perhaps my own, just to make sure that we have the necessary audible levels we need to follow what is said and to understand clearly. So please do not take offense. If I mute your microphone at any point during the briefing, it would purely be to ensure that the briefing is successful and effective. And of course, that will I will try to work within the constraints that we have. We've experienced a few seconds of lag here and there. That isn't Dr. Cronier just pausing for thought, although he does do that often, which is good because thought is necessary and pausing is oftentimes important. But when such things occur, I will try to manage it by intervening and perhaps just asking the speaker in question to go back a few seconds. But please bear with us. And as I say, thank you very much for your attendance. That being said, I will now give over to Dr. Cronier to please take us through these scenarios. Dr. Cronier, over to you.
Good morning to everybody. Harriman, thank you. I take it people can see my screen, and I take it that they can see me toggling through my screen. Is that correct?
I can certainly see your screen and your expression in the smaller block.
Good. Right. Well, good morning to you all. About 10 days ago, I started an exercise with my colleagues to try and understand the likely evolution of this COVID pandemic. And we started at a global level and developed some global South African scenarios. And we thought we'd share this morning.
Dr. Cronier, I do apologize to jump in so early, but I think we did lose about 10 seconds worth of speaking there. So if you could just recap a few seconds.
Yeah, no, sorry, Harriman. Harriman will interrupt me if you lose my feed a little bit. I said about a week, 10 days ago, we started this exercise to develop a scenario set for how COVID would likely affect the world. It started at a global level, these scenarios. We're now busy working them down to South African scenarios. And that work's very much in progress, but we thought we'd share some of its early conclusions with yourselves. The order of things from me this morning is as follows. I'll start with what our objectives were in this exercise. The core assumption which we base this specific scenario set on. Then I get into things we call key driving forces. Now, in the scenario world, the key driving force is a trend, usually a social, economic, or political one of such incredible importance that how it plays out becomes quite definitive in determining the outcome for a particular strategic problem. And the key driving forces in this case were picked because how they evolve will literally determine whether people live or die, or whether people are impoverished, or whether people will come out of this COVID thing in reasonable financial shape. Once the key driving forces are set out, there are 15 of those. I'll take you through how we rank them. Now, when we build scenarios, we rank key driving forces according to two measures. The first measure is what impact do we think this force will have on the evolution of the pandemic? And in this case, we're studying a pandemic. The second ranking is how uncertain are we about that evolution? Forecasters typically engage in trying to overcome uncertainties. They are employed by their clients or the people they advise to beat uncertainty and to give the client a clear sense of future evolution. Well, within the IRR, I think we've got enough experience to be very cautious of that. And rather than trying to beat uncertainty, we often seek it out to try and understand what are the things that we understand very little about, and to use them, uncertainty essentially, as one of the units of analysis in our broader analyses. Once we've ranked for impact and uncertainty, I'll take you into the scenario matrix and I'll talk you briefly through the scenarios and explain to you how we think the pandemic evolves in South Africa and some reference to the rest of the world over coming weeks and months. So thereafter, I'm done and I hand over to my policy colleagues to talk you through some of the points of advice that they think the country should now pursue. That is based on an incredible document they've produced in very short time, 100-page, a policy advisory report on how South Africa can best save lives while ensuring that livelihoods are not too negatively affected. At that point, we take your questions. My objectives are to try and help you understand the answers to these five questions. What is the likely trajectory of the COVID pandemic going to be for the world and South Africa? How long will the pandemic last? How will it affect people and their health? What are the economic ramifications going to be, and how should these be addressed? And finally, what will it take to stop the virus? Well, what is the end point when we see something appear on the horizon? How do we know that that is something that heralds the world and South Africa moving out of this crisis? Now, we want to be very clear on one thing this morning, that this scenario set is based on the common assumption most governments and various experts about the morbidity and fatality rates associated with COVID-19. And generally, those assumptions are these. 80% of people around the world could be infected. In the region of 10% of those people might become very ill. And between 1% and 2% of people who become very ill and infected may die as a result of this pandemic. But there is a growing volume of minority opinion and research that suggests that these assumptions might be off. They are now contested. And the IRR has developed a minority scenario set in the event that later testing data proves that the assumptions above those three were not spot on. That minority set is, however, not the subject of this briefing this morning. This briefing and this scenario set is based on the official assumptions proving correct. And we urge people to consider that they might be these worst cases, particularly to be aware there is a minority view emerging.
Dr. Cronier, unfortunately, we lost you again there. You were just saying about, unfortunately, these worst cases, and then we cut out.
Sorry, Harriman, this feed is a bit problematic. But no, the point I was making is that there is a minority view around. Our advice is to be aware of it, but to our policy advice is based on the official assumptions being correct, particularly given the lives that hang in the balance. But I'm sure some of my, separate from today's exercise, some of my policy colleagues who are reading into this minority view might be willing to talk to some journalists about it. Now, when we build scenarios, we identify what we call key driving forces. And key driving forces, as I said, are these trends of such incredible importance that in the case of this pandemic, they will be influential in determining who lives and dies, who's impoverished, and who comes out of this in relatively good shape. We've identified 15 of those. As many of you are already working and writing in this field, I don't need to dwell on them, so I will take you through them very quickly. In no particular order, the first one that comes up in our analysis is reaction times from governments and mass testing. And it would seem to be the case that governments that moved really quickly on this thing and tested widely have been able to manage the pandemic far better than those who waited. And we made the example in a document we produced for some corporates that of Taiwan, for example, screening flights out of Wuhan last year already. Lessons it had learnt from the 2004 SARS outbreak. And then by contrast, societies that waited relatively longer, the Iranians, the Italians, the EU, the United States now trying to put out a fire. I see Mr. Trump this morning considering a clamping down on domestic flights within that country. On impact, we ranked this force, the reaction times and mass testing in order to manage the pandemic as the third most important driver of how the pandemic was likely to evolve. And on uncertainty, how much did we understand about this force? We ranked it midway through the rankings. Now, I'll here just make one point that I won't repeat later on, that even if something is ranked relatively low down on impact or uncertainty, that does not mean we understand it well, and it does not mean it is unimportant. The 15 things, trends we've assembled here are all assembled because of their extraordinary importance in determining the evolution of the pandemic, and we understand few of them very well. Second one for us was median age, and again, it was early days, so there's still a lot of data to come in, but it does appear as if younger populations might weather this thing better than older ones. The Italian example, median age 47, against the Chinese example, median age 37 is something to ponder. In South Africa's case, we have one great advantage here in facing the pandemic, that only 35% of people in our country are over the age of 35. But the most vulnerable South Africans by age, older people, are very exposed. We saw that in social grant collections last week, which really was quite counterproductive in seeking to protect older generations from infection. On impact, we ranked it relatively low down, not to say that's unimportant. And on uncertainty, we understand age profiles and demographic trends relatively well. Domestic travel, critically important in order to interrupt the spread of a virus through a society. Congested transport services will greatly hinder, particularly in countries with sophisticated infrastructure, such as South Africa, efforts to isolate regions and individuals. The Chinese rail networks have been shut down, an example of that. South Africa's taxi industry, a very sophisticated transport system, runs on great infrastructure, but it packs people into close confines with each other. And the extent to which controls on the taxi industry have been relaxed over the past 24 hours will, we think, undermine somewhat attempts at making sure that this 21-day shutdown and the isolation protocol succeed as they might have. On impact, relatively high up, uncertainty towards the bottom third of the uncertainty ranking. Speed of new infection. This is a critical factor. I think this is not contested at all. Most COVID cases are mild, but a percentage of cases become serious and they require hospitalization. And the fear here is this, that if the virus, therefore, is allowed to spread too quickly, there's no sense really anywhere that the spread of the virus can be. That minority share of cases.
Apologies, Dr. Cronier, we lost you at the no evidence. You were speaking specifically about the spread of the virus.
Thank you, Harima. Yeah, the spread of the virus is that there's no evidence that you can prevent the spread of the virus. The consensus view is it will spread across societies. But the critical thing is the speed of that spread. Because if it spreads too quickly, the minority share of cases that are serious overwhelm the ability of healthcare systems to treat the ill, and that triggers a humanitarian health crisis. And it's really this a fear that saw the abandonment of Mr. Johnson's thesis in the UK of a herd immunity in that country, ranked on impact and then ranked on uncertainty. Patterns of infection, we think this is a key question in determining the trajectory of the pandemic. And there are three hypotheses here. The first, the most frightening one, is of an exponential infection curve. That's the idea that the number of infections could double every 2 to 3 days until 80% of people are infected in the society. Health systems are greatly overwhelmed, and that triggers the humanitarian health crisis. The second hypothesis is what China might try to get the world to believe it has achieved, which is there's an initial spike in infections and then draconian isolation efforts are introduced. And that depresses the viral load in a society to a very low level, and that the viral load will remain at that low level, even effectively extinguishing the virus. Obviously, it's still present and will remain so, and until a vaccine is available. But the society, after its initial push at isolation, will be able to continue somewhat normally after that. Then there's a third hypothesis, and this is the one of multiple peaks and troughs of infection, and what the waves of second and third waves. And what this hypothesis holds is that there'll be an initial spike, and then isolation efforts will help to flatten that curve. Whereafter, instead of maintaining a low viral load in for very many months, there'll be future waves of infection. We think this is likely the probable pattern for South Africa. And be aware there that those spikes will not be national spikes. They'll be regional spikes, and they will be sectoral spikes. And they will require what we later call a firefighting approach to deal with the crisis, where isolation efforts, shutdown efforts might become more regional, localized, and focused on specific sectors, ranked again on impact and uncertainty. Then there's the question of population density, quite obvious, the impact implications of this. Consider that over 2 million South African households, or think of them as families is better, live in shack settlements. That's out of a total number of in the region of 15 million families in the country. And we think that is true, the bullet point you see there. Population density may turn out to be inversely proportional to the success of isolation efforts, and we've ranked those again on impact, and we've ranked them on uncertainty. Then isolation efforts themselves, we're pretty clear on this, I think, and I think the global position is too, that isolation is the most effective means to prevent a humanitarian health catastrophe as it flattens that curve. And here you can rely on voluntary measures, a social pressure. Social media might be very important here, frowning upon institutions that cram people together, or people who travel around extensively, exposing others to infection. And then there can be involuntary measures, such as those now introduced in South Africa. And those do run the risk of serious civil rights abuses, and we are concerned about some of the behavior we've seen out of the Defence Force and out of the police. And not a new concern, that for the IRR. It's a long-running concern, and I think that greater policy attention and scrutiny and activist effort needs to be focused upon, ranked on impact and uncertainty. Then international travel. Obviously, the ability and willingness to interrupt international travel and networks will greatly facilitate clamping down on the flattening of a curve in a particular jurisdiction. Is the question here, did South Africa move a little bit late on this, considering the extent to which infections were imported? That will later be asked. On impact, we've ranked that. On uncertainty, we've ranked it. Temperature and changing seasons. Now, this may turn out to be really important, both for the world in the immediate weeks ahead and for South Africa, in particularly about 6 months down the line. The research, again, is not entirely conclusive, but there is evidence to suggest that this virus does not like warmer climates. Now, much of the world's infections in January already, Singapore, Thailand, Argentina, countries that have Dr. done Korea. That have not. Yeah,
I do apologize. We lost you at much of the world. You were about to, I think, explain the climatological considerations in much of the world.
Yeah, I think. Let me go back to that. Sort of the point I'm making is this: is that much of the Northern Hemisphere is now moving into its relative summer. And this might turn out to be very important in helping those societies flatten their curves. And then they could take some solace perhaps from the sort of Australian, Singapore, Thailand, Argentinian examples, countries that have problems but have not developed the types of crises that we saw around Milan and northern parts of Italy. And we can quite sustain the argument, and it's only that now, that as the effects of isolation in Northern Hemisphere countries coincide with the vast quantums of stimulus introduced into their economies, and as they move into their summers, you can begin to see outcomes where much of the world pulls out of the crisis of the pandemic, and not the pandemic and the broader problem itself, but the dire crises that the pandemic might pose sooner than is feared. South Africa, however, is moving into its winter. And if being a country of relatively young people, the point I made earlier, is very much in our favor, I think moving into winter is not. The 10-day weather forecast for much of the sort of high-filled regions of the country now suggests evening and nighttime temperatures slipping into the mid and even low teens. And we've ranked that again on impact and on uncertainty. Then there's the question of monetary and fiscal policy, and we'll make a very particular point on South Africa here. It's exceptional, extraordinary how much money has been poured into markets by wealthy economies, rivaling figures that were poured into those economies in the aftermath of the financial crisis. And in parallel with that, central banks have cut rates now, European, American central bank rates to extremely low levels. Yeah, South Africa has a particular problem because it entered the COVID crisis in very weak shape. Growth forecast ahead of COVID at about a fifth of emerging market norms. the minister in his budget speech in February, a deficit of negative 6.8% against the forecast Treasury growth rate of 0.9%. Now, that's catastrophic in and of itself before you introduce a COVID. Government debt levels have doubled over the past decade. Unemployment has been rising, and the official rate at around 29% is a multiple of emerging market norms. Contrast this to how South Africa entered the financial crisis in 2008. In that era, it entered it on the back of 4 years of economic growth that was on average higher than 5%. It was running a budget surplus, amazing to think, and its debt levels had been cut in half by the ruling African National Congress. It does not have, partly because of the populist policies of much of the preceding period up to COVID, South Africa does not have the stimulus or rescue package capacity to mitigate the economic fallout of shutdown to the same extent as is the case for much of Asia, Europe and North America. And we think this is going to become critical, because I'll later make the point that isolation and shutdown efforts are probably only sustainable if the economic damage they cause can be mitigated to a great extent. And South Africa does not have the capacity to do that. And that raises for us a primary question about whether isolation will succeed and shutdown will succeed here, and failing which, you open the way to these horrible possibilities of the exponential infection curve. On the question of markets, so stock markets around the world have experienced a considerable sell-off. My colleagues and I think I probably speak for most of them, have always been deeply skeptical of stimulus efforts since after the financial crisis. And I think in markets surrendering initially around 30%, you saw a lot of that stimulus money washing out of markets. But is this a correction? Have markets, in fact, found a floor, as many advisors would have their clients believe now, on the back of the sell-off? Or is there something else? Is there, in the global scenario set that we initially developed, there's definitely an outcome globally out of COVID, where it is to the world what the 1929 stock market crash was to the depression of the 1930s. South Africa, given the weak state in which of entering a long-term recession.
Dr. Cronje, I think if you could just pick up from South Africa entering this crisis in a weak state. We just lost you as you were speaking about the 1930s depression.
Yeah, no, the point I've made, Harriman, thank you for that, is that, you know, does this thing turn out on the global scale to be the 1929 crash and what that was to what would happen in the 1930s? Regardless of the global question, regardless of that, South Africa, given the weak state in which it's entered this crisis, looks assured it will trigger probably a long-term recession here, and I'll share some of our estimates and numbers in a moment. Public compliance, I think this is another question on which we've thought especially hard. Short of an authoritarian response, much of the government's sort of policy edict on isolation requires the public support. And the question then arises, what if the public will not comply with those edicts? And here, far too little, I think, has been written on the psychological effects of prolonged isolation, particularly when those are matched with what we call here the imminence of growing impoverishment of literally millions of people. And I think the political leadership of the country has had an easy ride over the past week or so because of the political assurance that "don't worry" is I think, how it's carried into the public domain. We know that your job's on the line. We know that your business is on the line, but we have a plan for that. When it emerges, I think, as it will, that in fact, those plans are not sufficient to wholly mitigate the loss of income that so many institutions and individuals now face, matched with that psychology of isolation, I think it will be very difficult. It will become a profound challenge to maintain isolation protocols here over the long term. Failure to comply then obviously jeopardizes containment of the virus, but worse than that, it could lead to considerable social disorder. And we flag this as a key risk, particularly if our fears of heavy-handed security force action continue, ranked on impact and uncertainty. Then the ability to work through the pandemic becomes... We conclude in our thinking that the sustainability of isolation strategy will probably in the long term depend on a labor force's ability to work from home or under conditions of relative isolation. We support the idea of isolation completely. But if that comes at the price of economic collapse, then isolation protocols will themselves fail, setting up the curve escalation and healthcare crisis that those efforts are seeking to avoid. And we've disagreed with the comment where it has been made that, look, this is a healthcare crisis, so put the economic concerns aside. We think they're very much the same concerns, and they need it, and they need to be addressed collectively. Primary, secondary, tertiary sectors, of course, affected very differently, further exposing the most vulnerable people in our society to the effects of an economic contraction. And advice, and my colleagues will say it later too, is that as much economic activity as possible must be encouraged to continue under relative isolation protocols. And I think this has been a flaw in the South African government's approach to shutdown, which has sought to draw a distinction between essential services and others. That distinction really doesn't apply in any economy. And what the distinction should rather be is the question of, can you proceed with your economic activity to within isolation protocols to such an extent that you do not pose a serious risk to public health? If that is the case, then such activity needs to be encouraged and needs to continue, ranked on impact and uncertainty. A vaccine is important. Obviously, it's important. And why is it important? It's important because if seasonal changes are not sufficient to greatly undermine the passage of the virus through a society, and if mutations to the virus don't occur that make it less virulent, we'll make a comment on this later, and if herd immunity theories fail, then the only way left to stop the virus is through the development of a vaccine. This will occur, we're fairly confident. How long will it take? 18 months, possibly shorter. It has $1 billion behind it now. Completed, and the many others, heroic efforts are being undertaken to ensure that this will occur. It is an important measure, the vaccine, in the sense that the time it takes for it to enter societies, the vaccine, will determine the maximum duration of the viral crisis, and therefore we ranked it very highly on impact, on uncertainty. We fairly certain there will be one. A mutation, we speak to people, experts in these things, and the viruses apparently are able to mutate. They can become more virulent, and that risk must be flagged. We can be grateful on this virus, as a serious threat to human health as it is, that it is not more virulent. And it seems to, the evidence suggests, spare children to a relative extent. And again, that is something to be grateful for. Far more dangerous pathogens and viruses and plagues and the like have marked as milestones in human history. Or could the potency of the virus diminish? That's a question that was asked in the scenarios and therefore help us get out of this crisis sooner than we'd feared. Far too early to model this effectively, so we raise it as an issue. On impact, a very high on uncertain, on impact, relatively low on uncertainty. Look how highly we rank that, given what its effects may be. Allow me now to just stand back from what I've taken you through and show you the collective rankings on one graphic. Starting with the, let me find my laser pointer for you, and there I can show you. These are our rankings on impact that I've taken you through now. The factor, the force, the driving force of greatest impact on the evolution of the virus, the development of the vaccine, given that it delineates the end point of the viral, of the COVID-19 viral crisis. Thereafter, public compliance, because if the public cannot comply with isolation protocols, then they break down and then you risk that exponential curve crisis. Reaction times from governments are ranked third. And of course, we ranked it below on impact public compliance because the question is, will the public comply with whatever edicts emerge from those reaction times? And the subsequent 12 factors ranked below them. And I reiterate, which I said I would not, that just because something is relatively low down these rankings does not mean it is an unimportant factor. It is literally a life and death factor now. Then we rank things on uncertainty to try and understand what are the things that we know the least about. And public compliance for us came out as our top uncertainty. We just don't know if it's sustainable. And this came out on the global set that we started with. We ranked it that highly. In South Africa's case, given the imminence of impoverishment of so many people, densely packed poor communities, security force action, we were even more uncertain. Mutation second, isolation efforts third, relative to public compliance, of course, and mutations, given the influence that both those factors would have on the success of isolation, fiscal and monetary responses, and the subsequent factors ranked beneath those. Now, when we build scenarios, what we do is we seek to select out of the driving forces of greatest impact an axis of a scenario matrix. And we seek to match that with an axis that we draw out of the factors of greatest uncertainty. And in this case, the scenarios I present to you this morning, the horizontal axis is the uncertainty axis. And our greatest uncertainty, as I showed you on the previous graphic, is isolation protocols and public compliance. Will they succeed for as long as they are needed, or will they fail when they are needed the most? That's the spectrum of possibility. Against that, the factor of greatest influence is the availability of the vaccine when it is needed, or will the vaccine not be available when it is needed the most, and how we plot those against each other, how you, in a sense, leverage impact against uncertainty, creates four quadrants. And each of the quadrants is a potential scenario. It's a potential future strategic environment that our country may now move itself through. There's the same axis, vaccine availability and not available, isolation succeeding and isolation failing, done somewhat more colorfully in order for me to introduce you to the scenarios. The first scenario occurs in the top right quadrant. And it occurs, look how we've used the.
I do apologize to interrupt, Dr. Cronier. We lost you at a crucial point there when you just started discussing the viral containment scenario.
Aha. Thank you, Harima. What I said is the top right quadrant gave rise to a scenario that we called viral containment. And look how we've used the axes to create that scenario. We've said in this scenario, isolation protocols are likely to succeed in blunting the curve. As a result of that, the humanitarian health emergency will be avoided to some extent, given that healthcare facilities will have time to prepare and a relatively low flow of critically ill patients to take care of. They'll save many lives, and the worst of the mortality figures will not materialize. Implicit for us in isolation protocol succeeding is that a significant degree of economic activity will again be allowed to continue within the protocols of isolation. And further, that those sectors or businesses or individuals who lose jobs and incomes will be able to be carried by stimulus and rescue package efforts to a sufficient extent. Should that not be the case, should there be mass impoverishment, or should supply chains be completely broken down, then we don't think isolation can succeed. So we argue that isolation succeeds, it blunts the curve, economic activity continues, rescue packages are effective, and that is the environment South Africa will remain in for the period of around 18 to 24 months until a vaccine becomes available. So 18 to 24 months is the time frame we put on viral containment. We will avoid the worst of the economic and healthcare risks that we face now, and we will emerge in 18 to 24 months' time to pick up the pieces and to begin to rebuild. The second scenario suggested by the axes we've written off. It's internally contradictory. It doesn't work. It suggests that isolation will succeed while a vaccine will never become available. We believe the vaccine will be available, and we don't think isolation could succeed into perpetuity. So we write this one off. It no longer exists in our analysis. We have three to work with. The worst case for South Africa, you can extrapolate this to the world, is the scenario we've named viral obliteration. And this time we've used the axes as follows. We firstly said that isolation protocols will fail. So if we describe the narrative of events here for you in South Africa's case, those protocols, you might argue, are already failing, given the pensioners standing in the queues to collect their pensions and then standing in queues at supermarkets, the restrictions lifted on the taxi industry, the sheer impossibility, that will later be established, of isolating people in densely packed informal communities. As isolation protocols begin to fail and economic setbacks will see them fail progressively across society in short order. The infection will not be able to be staunched to any extent. And the worst case becomes that we see that exponential infection curve. 80% of people are infected in a matter of weeks. The worst of the mortality and morbidity estimates emerge. Healthcare sector is totally overwhelmed. We face the humanitarian healthcare catastrophe. These terrible scenes of northern Italy around Milan will become our scenes. And when we need it the most in this window, the vaccine, of course, is not available because it's still many months, perhaps more than a year away. The time frame on viral obliteration is 3 to 4 months, because that's how long it would take, we think, for the virus exponentially to sweep through the society. And it ends in 3 to 4 months because herd immunity has developed in South Africa, and we will proceed to pick up the pieces. But the price for that in this scenario will be the deaths of a great many people and deaths that might otherwise have been avoided. The third scenario is what we call viral firefighting. And this time we use the axes as follows. We said that isolation protocols in South Africa will progressively begin to fail, not the complete collapse that we speak of in the viral obliteration scenario in bottom left. They'll progressively fail. They'll fail more in some jurisdictions. They will fail. And as they fail, what the country will begin to
do. I think the specifics of how these isolation protocols might fail, we miss. Journalists might be very interested in those specifically.
It's a critical point, Harriman. Thank you again for your interruption. The manner in which isolation protocols fail in viral firefighting, it's not the blanket national failure that we warn of in the bottom left viral obliteration scenario. It's more a sectoral or regional. It's the failures are limited to specific sites, sectors. And what will happen here is that after our first national effort to blunt the curve via this initial shutdown, the South African government will face a series of peaks and troughs of infection, sweeping across this society in multiple waves, the emergence of each peak requiring a specific new, sometimes quite draconian series of lockdown provisions in specific areas and regions of the country. And hence we call it the firefighting approach. The economic consequences to those specific regions requiring further firefighting emergency measures in order to mitigate as far as possible the economic consequences. And we will move through this crisis for a number of months. And then just at the point that we think it couldn't possibly continue, that the society threatens or risks being overwhelmed, and that being overwhelmed, we will fall into the scenario of viral obliteration. South Africa, the world, if you extrapolate to global, is saved. And it's saved by one of a series of factors. The first is the early availability of a vaccine. That means that we've held the line as best as we could, and at the point where we might have been defeated by this virus, the early vaccine saves us, or any other country which would be in a similar position. But in this scenario, you can substitute vaccine for mutation or a seasonal effect. And South Africa will be moving back into its spring and summer in about 6 months' time. So you can put a time on viral firefighting of as short an era of about 6 months, when the seasonal effect will be back in our favor and may be useful in helping us emerge from the scenario. We don't think that there is a fifth outcome here. And we think that broadly, any chain of events that South Africa will now experience will fall somewhat. You'll shoehorn it into the confines of one of the three scenarios that have survived our initial assessment. Give you a little bit more detail on the numbers that we're starting to produce out of each scenario. There's viral containment. It was the top right quadrant. Viral obliteration, bottom left. And then viral firefighting was top left. In terms of duration, viral containment, 18 to 24 months, because the vaccine is necessary to bring it to an end. And we will learn to operate within the confines of the economy. We'll learn to operate within the confines of isolation to a far greater extent than now appears to be the case. Viral obliteration, 3 to 4 months, given the herd immunity outcome. Firefighting, as short as 6 months, given the seasonal effect, and as long as 18 months, given the early availability of a virus. You might also make that one 6 to 12 months. The effect on people, we try to measure that in terms of work. Initially, we think the case now is that in the region of between 7 and 10 million, think of them this way, 7 to 10 million people who a month ago were reasonably confident of getting an income are probably now in a position where they would not be confident anymore that that income, the full extent of it, will be available to them in the weeks and months ahead. In viral containment, we start with that number, a consequence of the present shutdown, and that sees the unemployment rate spike to 40% plus, and that figure will then taper downwards as protocols are put in place that allow more sectors to begin operating again within the confines of reasonable measures of containment. Viral obliteration, we start with that same number of people, and the costs to society will see the unemployment spike to 50% plus. Now, note that we have not put a ceiling on that number. You start with the same numbers of people, but after national level, but more on a regional or geographic or sectoral level. And again, the risk is that our unemployment figure might escalate to a quite extraordinary extent. Economic growth, containment, we could get away with. We are in recession under all these outcomes. Under containment, if it's well done and a fair amount of activity is back, economic activity, we might get away with an economic contraction as limited as -2%, but it could be as broad as -5%, we think, depending on global factors. Remember, South Africa is a very small ship, a boat, in fact, a raft, as some might say, afloat in a very big and tempestuous sea. We account for less than 0.5 percentage point of global GDP. And then also here, the speed to which we can taper people back into work and the efficacy of what a rescue, fiscal, other measures and might be introduced by private sector players and the South African government. Viral obliteration, we're looking at a very deep recession. And in my conversations with some economists that I hold in high regard over recent days, there is a view that that negative 7% number might be optimistic, and hence it has a plus on it. And again, no ceiling. And firefighting, you're looking at very, very deep contractions again for the duration of the pandemic. Then of course, setting up the long-term era of recovery. In terms of the healthcare effects, containment, 30 to 60% of people infected, of which below 1% of that number will die. And the reason why we're at the lower end of the estimate there is that the curve will have been sufficiently blunted and enough time will have been bought in this initial 21-day shutdown for healthcare providers, public and private, to be geared to treating the proportion of people who become ill. Viral obliteration, the worst case outcome materializes, and firefighting, we put the figures between the two. The internal political stability of the country remains good under viral containment because a sufficient...
Dr. Cronier, I do apologize. Can I just pause for a moment? I'm just going to mute all participants and ask you to unmute yourself thereafter.
Right. Have you got me back again?
Indeed.
Very good. Internal stability, political stability of viral containment, good. There's the economic cost is not as severe as we'd feared. And hence, which is always the great driver, it has been the case in our analysis for decades of internal instability in the country. Viral obliteration, you must experience a sharp deterioration in internal instability. And on the back here of some numbers we have worked on the past decade that already show a very sharp escalations in levels of violent protest action in the country. And I might go a little bit further here and say, given insights developed out of polling we conducted around the 2019 election, I don't think it is too far-fetched to say that the consequences of viral obliteration, healthcare will be devastating, the economy devastating. But it might be sufficiently sufficient of an inflection point to later trigger political changes in South Africa on a scale of what the country last experienced in the 1980s and 1990s, and viral firefighting, high volatility. On the question of the end events, the vaccine is the end event for containment, herd immunity for obliteration, and the firefighting, the end event, is the early vaccine or a seasonal effect or a mutation. And that is my contribution for this morning. Harriman, I thank you for introducing me and for chairing. I stay in the background of this meeting and hand over now to some of my colleagues on policy, but I will be available to take your questions towards the end of this briefing and also beyond that if further questions arise. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cronier. Just to reassert, I will be muting all participants again. I hope everyone can hear me. Just as a note, if you open the chat function of the Teams bar, what should happen is you should have a little bar of about 10 centimeters in the middle of your screen that has a recording indication on the to the left of it and to the right of it, hang up option. Just to the left of the red button to hang up, there's a little icon that looks like two people, and just to the left of that, there's a speech bubble. Now, if you click on that speech bubble, you will be able to access the presentation that Dr. Cronier just gave in PDF form, and also the latter part of that presentation, of that PDF, is also that which my colleague Nick Babaya will now take us through. Please, any questions, please alert me to the fact that you want to ask a question based on whatever you might hear, and once my colleague Mr. Babaya has concluded, I will take the questions in hopefully what turns out to be a systematic approach. That being said, my colleague Nick Babaya, who's a researcher, will now be introducing 10 policy recommendations, proposals made by the IRR, mostly drawn from the 97-page document Dr. Cronier mentioned at the very start, but also newer proposals that have been developed in succeeding days and will form part of the IRR's policy recommendation output files or output attempts in coming weeks. That being said, Nick, floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Harman. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Cool. Perfect. Do we have the slideshow coming up?
Yes. I hope it is visible. Is it visible?
Yeah, visible for me. Thanks very much. You can go to the first page. All right. Thank you very much, everyone, for being here. As Harman already said, if you have any questions, you can put it in the chat box. Just to mention once again, most of proposals which I'm now about to talk about come from the IRR's report. You can see a picture of it there on the right-hand side. It's really a fantastic document with input from all the greatest minds of the Institute of Race Relations, so I highly encourage you to go and have a look. All right, Harman, can we please have the next slide? All right, so to start things off, the emergency COVID-19 treatment vouchers. The idea for this is to understand that scarcity is going to be an enormous problem when this pandemic in South Africa really hits a crisis point. We already have a number of problems documented by the IRR and the public health system. So we have put forward a proposal to give private healthcare vouchers for people who are particularly vulnerable to COVID-19 or people who are in difficult financial situations. Just to give a brief overview, the way this would work is that you'd have to, first of all, the vouchers would be given directly to hospitals, and there would simply be a payment route that would go straight to the Treasury or some other relevant government department. In order to fulfill the criteria to use one of these vouchers, you'd have to pass two criteria. The first is that you test positive for the coronavirus, the novel coronavirus. And the second is that you fulfill one of a number of criteria which designates you as what we would call somebody who's particularly vulnerable to COVID-19. This could be someone with suppressed immune system, a chronic respiratory disease, somebody who's particularly elderly, or somebody who's particularly poor, perhaps. So that is the voucher system. Harman, the next point, please. The isolation, thank you very much. The isolated care vouchers. Likewise, there are many people living in informal settlements in South Africa and other living situations, which makes it very difficult for them to self-isolate. Similar to the voucher system from hospitals, seeing as hotels and other places of accommodation, which make their money largely from tourism, we suggest giving vouchers to these places of accommodation. And the idea here is that if your living situation is not conducive to self-isolation, you can go to one of these places of accommodation and stay there, almost like as a safe haven where you can self-isolate. And then converting public infrastructure to temporary medical facilities. This has been done in a number of countries around the world, places like halls, school halls, university residences, even stadia they were doing in the UK I saw recently. And the idea here is that, you know, the government owns these places already, so they won't have to jump through any hoops to use them. And the idea, and we can use these facilities if they're converted to medical facilities, really for cases where patients have a serious case of COVID-19, but not so serious that they require intensive care. Of course, if you do need to be in ICU and be on a ventilator, then you should probably go to a hospital. Next slide, please, Harman. Accessing UIF funds, we anticipate that there will be probably many, many millions of South Africans who could be put off work either through retrenchments or being put on unpaid leave. In cases like this, we would simply say that these workers should go onto UIF in order to maintain cash flow. Again, this is part of the whole objective of trying to lessen the economic impact of the virus. Next one, please. Encouraging banks to renegotiate debt repayment plans. Of course, we wouldn't want to force any banks to do anything. I think the consequences of making financial institutions do things which are totally against their balance sheet is extremely unwise. But we are very happy and we endorse that. It seems like a lot of banks in the private sector have actually come to the forum and in goodwill have said, okay, we're going to be nice and allow our customers to renegotiate debt repayment policies. It's actually to the benefit of banks in any case, because a whole number of clients defaulting on their debt would not be good either. Then on the tax holiday advice, this one is slightly technical. I'll just explain it. So it comes out of Australia, the idea. Normally, if you have a certain amount of money which you would contribute to a monthly annuity, such as a pension fund or something like that, that would get removed from your taxable income. We would like to propose that people who would instead keep that money for their own use in cash do not get that added to their taxable income. Rather, the tax exemption still remains, and that can be left in place for the forthcoming financial year, or otherwise, depending on the situation of the virus. Next slide, please. The use of military logistics. Of course, the military are currently on our streets assisting the police. We haven't quite reached a state of emergency yet, but they are doing law enforcement jobs. But the military also has a lot of logistics of its own. It owns a lot of vehicles. And we think these could be good use to use these vehicles to deliver things like food and medicine to people in certain communities. The idea here is also just to lessen the need for people to leave their residences. We also came up with the idea of the Emergency Citizen Volunteer Service, and this is an interesting idea. I think the idea here is to create a volunteer service for citizens, perhaps citizens who think they're quite healthy or those who have already recovered from the virus, who actually want to go volunteer to distribute things like food and medicine to perhaps poorer communities or informal settlements. And the idea here is that people would get kitted out with all the right protection kit, face masks, and the right medical equipment. And then people could actually volunteer and just lend their manpower to helping the situation. Next point, please. Yes, and this is also a suggestion which comes out of Germany. The idea is that if we exempt people who have already recovered from COVID-19 by doing antibody testing, we should allow them then to rejoin society, start work, be able to go outside, et cetera, et cetera. I think the important thing about something like this is that we want to emphasize that one of the most important things that that we have here is that people get back to their normal lives as soon as possible. This lockdown is extremely disruptive. So anything that can allow people to return to their daily lives as normal would be fantastic. Last slide, please, Herman. And then, with the lockdown comes a lot of new regulations, which the government has gazetted. There's been a bit of, not so much clarity about this. Government should simply publish simple language versions of all regulations related to the lockdown. No legalese, nothing confusing. Just put it in plain language so that there's broad understanding. And the final point, please, Herman. And to that end, law enforcement should also be educated on the regulations. In this time, law enforcement, we've already been seeing videos of some aspects of police brutality, and it's brought concern to us. And the fact is that the regulations are only good as the enforcement which enforces it. So it's vitally important that the police and the military also understand exactly who can and who can't go outside. Thank you very much. That's all from me.